How have you been?
I have been well. I don't even remember when we last spoke. Beginning of January?
Yes,
I think
I think
so. Beginning
yes,
of, yeah, 6th or 7th or something. And now it's 17th of February. I have been good. It's been a month or more of energies coming back. But also a month of me becoming more conscious and active when it comes to taking care of me. So I have said no to some things. I've said yes to some other things. You know, it's like it's been a period where I've been listening more closely and then taking action, whatever that action has needed to be. But it's so lovely to have the light be coming back. You know, it's like in the weekend or something, I think it was, I was sitting by the computer at, and it was like 5:10 in the evening, and I looked out and it was still daylight. It was like, yes, it's coming back. And
It's
it
coming.
makes such a big difference.
I don't know if I told you this. I don't know if I mentioned this to you generally when we spoke, or maybe on the podcast, or maybe I didn't mention it at all. But apparently, exposing yourself in the morning to first light, like when the sun is rising, exposing yourself to this light, you don't have to stare straight into the sun because that may just hurt your eyes, but you know, to blue sky, it actually is very, very beneficial to your brain, the function of your brain, and to feel not depressed. And that's so important. However, here in the Netherlands, I do wake up early now and before the sun goes up, but still here it's very rarely a blue sky
Blue
that I can
sky.
look to. It's just it's today we have it, but it's also extremely windy. Like, even if you want to have a walk, like, you ain't going to have a walk because it will just blow you away.
We have the same wind. It was really stormy in the night and it's still very, very windy. But we have just an even cloud cover. It's just gray. So no blue skies here. But
Yeah, but it's.
I was just listening to Braiding Sweetgrass, the book by Robert Wall Kimmerer, which I don't know how many of these podcasts I've been mentioning that book, but there's a section where one of the chapters is she takes her students, because she's a professor of botany, she takes students out to this place near the marsh swamps, and they build their own shelter, and they're discussing the placement of the door into the shelter. And one of the students kind of figures out, you know, we're here and the ocean is over there, it's windy, so it makes sense that we have the door on this side, on the east side, facing east. And Robin is kind of writing that, well, you'll see when the sun rises why it's a good thing to have it in the east, because then you will be met by the rising sun when you wake up. And it's kind of a similar thing, you know? It's like it's one of those things that we, our westernized modern man culture, is so far from those things that I think actually are very, very crucial for, amongst other things, mental well-being.
Yeah, precisely. I think we are so focused on our work, on achieving more at work, and I think we sometimes forget how important it is to get in touch more in na with yourself in nature. And you know, I was recently I had a conversation which was well initiated by a podcast that I was listening to, and a person in that podcast, I don't remember her name now, and I'm not sure if I'm going to say it exactly as she said, so I will be paraphrasing here, but she said something that we are, or we were, so influenced by the Western culture, and here she means United States, and we became like extremely focused on ourselves. Like, it's good to take care of yourself. It's good to think about yourself, but you also have to think about other people. And, you know, so that's kind of interesting, because I personally believe it's important that you focus on yourself and on your well-being, because if you are not okay, I guess other people won't be okay. But I also think that there is there has to be a proper balance, because if you're just only thinking about yourself and you don't care what's going on around you, around your environment, in your environment, and, you know, it can be your family, it can be as small as, I don't know, you and your child, or you and your partner, or, you know, like, or can be on a larger scale. And sometimes we forget to pay attention to this a little bit larger scale than ourselves. But it is important to focus on yourself, to take care of yourself, just to find also this balance where, the balance, basically, yeah. To find the balance.
Yeah, precisely. It is the, I would say that at least our culture, I don't know how cultural it is, but I also think it actually is kind of biological. It is like there is an inherent egocentricness to us, where we are centered in ourselves, because it is through my eyes, it is through my brain that I filter what I see, it is through my skin, it's like I have me as kind of the basis of where I then come to the world, right? So it's quite natural that we are. That is the starting point, but it should not be the end point, you know? Mm-hmm. If it kind of stays there, not a recipe for success, I would say. But you know, but making sure that I am well, making sure that I tend to myself, care for me, has been my mantra this month.
So how, if I can ask, how do you take care of yourself? What are the things that you do now to ensure that you're well?
So I've been sensing into myself more when it comes to really, it's been, I'm getting more aware of my energy levels. Mm-hmm. And it's coupled with what has been going on in my therapy sessions this month, which to a large extent has been pinpointing a fact where, for some reason, I have had this view, and probably still do to some extent, where we're unpeeling it as in the moment right now, that I need to be superhuman. I cannot be human. I cannot have the limits of being human. I should be superhuman. Mm. So if I look back at my life, I can see that I have, probably prompted by that, pushed myself way over my energy limits. And it's worked. Yeah. You know, it's worked. Mm. I haven't burnt and crashed. I haven't, you know, I haven't become depressed. I haven't become utmattningsdepression, we call it in Swedish, burnt out. You know, it's like I haven't done that. Right? But now, kind of just opening up and seeing that, oh, shit, I have this belief that I have to be superhuman makes me go down into the humanness of myself. So I've let myself be human. You know, I haven't gone to choir practice. Choir practice is one of those things that really, really I love. I love choir practice. It gets me energy, etc. But there was a time where I was like, no, not today. I'm just too tired. My normal me, and by normal, I mean the norm of me, not what's good for me. The norm of me would just have said, it's in your calendar, you do it.
Just do it.
Because that's what you do, right?
Yeah.
And I'm not saying just do it is a bad thing. I'm just, you know, I'm kind of in this wobbly field of figuring out what happens if I don't just do it because it's in the calendar, because I am the dependable one to others. What happens if I start to be more dependable to me?
Yeah.
And what's there?
Yeah. I think it's very, first of all, I would like to say that the word that you just said in Swedish, yes, that was, oh my gosh, that was it one word?
Utmattningsdepression. Yes, it is. It's a one word that's made up of two words. Utmattning means exhausted or exhaustion. Depression is depression.
It's like utmattning, yeah, okay.
Utmattningsdepression.
It actually sounds very, very beautiful. But when I listen to sometimes when you say some words in Swedish, I think it's much harder language to learn than Dutch. It's like,
and I totally disagree.
Really?
Yes, I totally disagree. It's like Dutch. Oh no, I wouldn't even know where to begin, because written Dutch and spoken Dutch seem to be two different languages. Dutch, I can kind of figure it out. Spoken Dutch, oh my God.
It's an interesting language, I would say. I found it, I don't know, sometimes I feel much more motivated to learn languages. And like when I was in Spain, I was like, yeah, just do it. And it was fun for me. With that, it's just, it's not that it's hard, because I feel like I have already some basics. I was here for so long time. I am here for a very long time. That I picked up a lot. And I remember when I moved into the Netherlands, I attended like for a month or two a school, and I like, you know, was reading the books. So now when I listen to Dutch on like, I tried to learn, I bought some courses, and, you know, I play them in my headphones when I go for a walk, and I talk to myself out loud, because you have to repeat certain words and phrases. But so I find that I remember a lot from the basic Dutch and from what I have learned 10 years ago. But it's still for me hard to just keep trying and talking in that language. And yeah, I don't know if it's just like a barrier that you develop with age, because when I was younger, I didn't care if I say something completely right or I will make mistakes and someone corrects me. I had fun about that. But yeah, just that was a side note. But
I wonder if the same is true in Sweden as it is in the Netherlands, or the other way around, that if you know English, you really don't have to. If you were only speaking Polish and you did not know English, man, you would learn Dutch.
Yeah,
because not enough Dutch people know Polish, I think. Or, yeah, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. I would agree with the statement. But who knows, maybe we will be surprised. If it's other way, I'll let you know if I find out that it's other way. But I really feel like most of Dutch people wouldn't speak Polish. And I think you're right, because especially in Amsterdam, when you live in Amsterdam, it's very easy to speak with anyone in English. Sometimes I feel like Dutch language will disappear in Amsterdam. I'm not saying called Netherlands, but in Amsterdam, because there are so many different cultures here. People just come from different countries, and most of them, they just speak English. And I'm kind of happy to hear that in Sweden is the same, because if I go visit, then I'll be like, yeah,
you'll
I can
be
speak
fine.
English.
You'll be fine.
And but when I was in Spain, and it was some time ago, so I assume it probably changed by now, but a lot of people did not speak English, at least the people that I worked with. So I just started learning Spanish, and that's it. And, you know, I think, like, Dutch, I don't know about Swedish, but Dutch and German should be very similar to English, because they are this Germanic languages or something, like, I'm not sure about that. But when
I don't dare say anything, because I have a listener who knows all of this, and he'll just say, oh, you said it wrong.
No, because the course that I'm learning, from which I'm learning now Dutch, the lady said that Dutch is very similar to English. Some words are super similar, which was helpful, because I can connect things a little bit better now, I guess, when I'm trying to learn Dutch. But yeah, I just find it interesting that some languages are so similar, and sometimes I kind of think, like, how it happened that we have so many different languages, but yet some of the things are so similar. So yeah. But another thing what I wanted to say is that, you know, taking care of yourself, and like how you said that you kind of try to figure out what's good for you. It's not like following the agenda and sticking to the agenda. And I think that's really good. And for me, like, sometimes I do feel very guilty if I don't stick to my agenda. It annoys me. But I think that's the part, like, the, I would say, old part of me. Like, you know, because I've been running like this for 30 years, you know, okay, 20 or 15, let's say, I don't know, like, since, I guess, I started going to school. I remember I would always study really hard. I would, like, read as much as I can. I was very ambitious, I guess you would say. And so since then, I remember I was always doing a lot of things, and I rarely said no to people. And I think it's important to be able to figure out which things are really good for you, beneficial for you. And I'm not, I don't mean financially only, but, you know, in terms of your health, in terms of your well-being. Like, if you figure out that what you really want and need, I think that will help you to say no to other things. But it takes a lot of filtering in your head, because I still have the habit of saying, oh yeah, sure, I will help you. And then I'm like, why did I just say that? And then I have to go back to that person, take it back what I say. And it annoys me. I'm frustrated with myself that on that day, on the spot, I wasn't able to kindly explain that, look, with all my love and everything, I would help you, but I cannot do it. I, like, have no space in my, like, current life to do that. And if, you know, like, because I also think that if we commit to something and we push ourselves to do it, despite the fact that we feel like, well, we barely can handle other stuff, it will impact the quality of our help. And sometimes it's better to not help at all, or than help in a poor way.
Yeah, and I think it's the quality of the relationship that that is at stake in some way. Where it's, you know, it's a fine line to walk. This, I love my friends and my family, and I want to be there for them. I love myself, and I want to be there for me. When I do things because I'm supposed to, or because it's expected.
Yeah.
You know, or because I fear what would happen if I said no, or, you know, it's like that can really muddle the field quite a lot. Whereas if, so I think there's something to speak Or there's something valid here when it comes to clarity. Clarity is an aspect of this that really helps. It's like if I can kind of anchor down into me, the relationship, the other people, the shoulds, the expectations, if I can kind of get clear on that, it's somehow easier to know what's the boundary here? What's valid here? What's good here? What will serve and what won't serve? And now and again, you know, you have a friendship, a relationship where, okay, I'm putting in more, right? Because I'm the one who has the energy or the time or the money or whatever it is. And at times it's the other way around. So, you know, it's like you can't, I don't strive for like it needs to be 50-50 and it needs to be equally even and everything. It's like that doesn't work. But in the dance of that thing,
yes,
like in the overall,
there is balance.
Scope.
Yes,
there is precisely.
A balance. And as you say, I think, you know, striving 50 for 50-50 or similar thing, it's, I don't know, it doesn't work for me either. And one person brings certain things into the relationship, and then the other person brings another things. And there is like this dance, as you said, you know. And sometimes it's a little bit clumsy dance, and then it may evolve to more beautiful dance. But, you know, this reminds me also about something that I read in Esther Perel books, one of her books. And it was about relationships and about when people seem to have a habit of wanting to be like a one unit when they are in a relationship. And she emphasizes that it's important that we keep our identity, you know, like we are two separate human beings in this relationship. And actually, it's what keeps us together, that there is still something that you have for yourself and this other person has for themselves. Maybe some things that you not always share, you know, like, for example, a simple thing, I think like a mobile phone, you know, like I personally do not strive for like having access to the mobile phone of my partner. I even don't wanna, it's like allow him to have it, but I know women who is like, well, I can access it, I can see what's in there and everything. And I even don't feel such a need because I want that person to have certain space for themselves. I want my partner to feel comfortable with what he is doing and keep his identity. He doesn't have to merge to become one with me, because that would be then you would have only yourself. Yes. Mm-hmm. And I guess that will be like a little bit, frankly, boring, because then you know that person so well and there are no secrets at all. And I'm not saying have secrets, you know, or I don't know, like, but allow them to have something for themselves.
Yeah, it's like, and I don't want this to come off as judging, because it makes me, it's rather, I'm curious about families who have a family email and not individual emails. It's like,
that's so strange. I would
maybe
say
I want to throw a surprise party. You know, it's like, it's an interesting sort of notion of everything has to be in the open. And like you say, it's like somehow it takes the charge off things. Some things, it's a good thing to take the charge off them. But to live a life without charge actually won't be life. Because even down to atom level, you know, it is all about charge. It's, you know, it's the constant shifting. It's the dance.
Yeah.
In the atom, the electrode, you know, it's the dance between I'm positive, I'm negative, I'm positive, I'm negative, right? So taking the charge out of everything by making it open. How do you do that? Yeah. How you would do, you know, it's like, because there is so much going on in here. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I think about that in therapy where Dominic asks a question or says something and I just kind of sit with me and what's going on in me, and he can sense it, but it's like, there's lots of things that just, they don't come out as words.
Yeah.
And it's not because I'm deliberately hiding, you know, it's just because that's kind of the way it is. It's like, I can't say everything. Then I would say, oh, now I'm looking at that flower and it has red leaves. You know, it's like, it's not possible to share everything.
Mm. Mm.
And I don't want it.
Sometimes it's hard to explain everything that you feel or go through. And I think a lot depends on the like a context, on the relationship that you have with the person and things that are happening around. Because with some people, you may open up more. And with other people, you won't do that. And as I'm saying, it depends on the relationship you have with the people, depending on the context. And I think this kind of nicely relates to this, what we spoke about last time. And that was the triggers, you know, like to talk about something or to not talk about something in front of a person. I think a lot depends also on the context and relationship because with that person that you have or that you established, the relationship that you established. Because you won't always, let's say, I don't know, let's say about the weight, yes, because that seems to be a topic that people don't want to touch often, and it's one of the forbidden things to ask or to talk about.
In Western cultures.
Yes, yes, mm-hmm. Exactly. Because in other cultures, mm-hmm. bigger weight or different weight is actually perceived as quite good thing.
And yeah, it's a caring thing. I had my India project 10 years ago or more, 12 years by now. And when one of the CEO of the Indian site came to Malmö to visit us, and he looked at me and said, oh, Helena, I think you've gained a couple of kilos. And the project leader was standing beside him saying, you know, don't say that. So Vivek then came to me afterwards, and the project leader had said to him, you know, we don't say that in Sweden. You know, you just don't touch that subject. It's a don't mention the war kind of subject. And Vivek came to me and they said, I'm so sorry. I didn't know that. And in Indian culture, it is a sign that I care for you, that I see you, and that I see that there's a shift in you, and I want to make sure that you're fine and okay, and if not, that I can do something about it, you know, or I can help you or support you. So, and I was like, it's absolutely fine, because I'm not very touchy on the subject, but but Western culture, it's a no, you don't.
I haven't yet finished reading the Woman Who Ran With The Wolves, but that was one of the things that she mentioned in her book, that I don't remember, but I think it was that she went somewhere for some research and or visited other people. And
the Mexican lady.
She was like, if she would be like too skinny, they would say, oh my gosh, you don't look good. I think I need to provide you with more food. You need to eat.
Yeah.
Come on. So, that's very interesting to see how other cultures perceive certain things. And I'm actually very open to discovering these things. And so when we talked about the weight or how much someone weighs and, you know, how they feel about this, and I guess, you know, like you're not going like with someone total stranger, you're not going to go to, well, in your case, it did happen. But
well, he wasn't a total stranger. We knew each other. We'd been working for a couple of years. So he was definitely a friend. Yeah.
Precisely. So, you know, if it's a total stranger, I guess you're not going to say, like, oh, what's your weight? I think you need to take care of yourself. You know, like I think if someone does it, I think there's something much more wrong with that person than, you know, like being honest is one thing, but you don't go randomly to people just say things like this. But, you know, like, if you know a little bit about the person and you have a discussion on certain topics, then posting or informing about, like, trigger warnings or, look, I'm going to start a conversation and there will be a trigger warning potentially, I find it a little bit strange. You won't do that. And the other thing is that I started now doing the sexological course, and in the first lecture, the professor said, I'm not going to put trigger warnings information or trigger warning information in that course, because you all know 300 people, you all know what did you sign up for. And we're going to talk about different things like genitals. Yes, we're going to look at different genitals. And I'm not going to put trigger warnings on my slideshow, or say each time that there may be something that will trigger something in you, because that's the course about, that's the faculty about. And if you're not okay with that, well, you maybe didn't have to sign up for it. So I found it interesting and somehow hopeful that the academic environment is kind of aware of that, but that they also have their stand on this topic. Like, look, you know what you sign up for. You understand this. So you're a thinking human being. So why do I have to give you now the warnings in this specific situation? So, but again, it's the context, it's the certain relationship that he has there with the people who are coming to the faculty. And I think this always have to be taken into consideration, the context and the relationship that you have with the human being.
Tell me more about that course, though. Is it online? Now, yes,
because of COVID restrictions, we cannot go to the university. So, University of Amsterdam provides a faculty of sexology, and anyone can sign up for it. You don't have to be a student, which is great for me, because, you know, I'm not sure if I would go and study 5 years of psychology, because, or sociology, or any other course that would allow me to investigate more the sexology. And so that was a great opportunity. I signed up for it. And yeah, they do it now online, the faculty, because, again, COVID. But if it will be possible, they will move it to the campus. So to do the sessions in the room with everyone in there. And I find it very interesting, the subject. I just love it. I keep reading that book. I keep learning super new things. And, like, you know, some things I can't do new in my head. And, like, for example, recently there was something about classical conditioning, and I think it's called, operant conditioning. So, you know, I was like, fuck, weird names, yes. And it's like, I have never heard those names. Where this classical conditioning is this Pavlov test with the dogs, and, you know, when they hear the ring, they
Pavlov
just
spells,
Pavlov's dogs, exactly. And then the other one is when you condition someone to do or to not do certain things by giving them rewards or punishment. But also they found out that there are a few principles that, for example, if it comes to this rewards or punishment, they are the most effective when they happen straight after the activity or the thing that someone did. So they give an example of someone catching an STI. Yes. So
the sexually transmitted infection.
Yes. Sorry. Yes, that's I should have explained that. I just yeah.
Well, I did. So
yeah, thank you very much. So when the person just have sex with another person and they catch STI, they may they don't know it directly. So despite the fact that having sex and unprotected sex with someone caused them this STI, they don't see it wasn't direct enough punishment for them to not do it again. And another thing, what they say, that punishment compared to rewards doesn't seem to shape the person as well as the rewards. So, you know, but those are things that I have heard in the past. I was exposed to it, but I didn't know that there are names on it before it and how to label it. And I'm not a big fan of labeling things, but in this case, it helps me to understand certain things, helps me to broaden my knowledge and to understand it in a better way. And there was a lot of information about, there is a lot of information about different sexual behavior in different cultures, and what's appropriate in one culture may not be appropriate in the other culture. I'm sure that we will be talking about sex work, and also we talked about Kinsey's research, and there is a film which shows it's kind of biographical film, but it's called Kinsey. And you know, like, I don't know the exact biography of him, so I don't know, I cannot say how precise was that film, but it was interesting. And one part of that film, the leading actor, he says that they look to certain images which were called pornographic images then, because they were quite explicit. They had explicit sexual acts. They were presenting explicit sexual acts. And so he looks to it and he's like, look how interesting is that, because it shows how culture is reflected in these pornographic images. And for me, it was like, bing, in my head. I was like, I want to look to that a little bit more. I want to find out a little bit more how it changed through the years, you know, because in the past, people who were creating these pornographic images, the sexual explicit acts on images, they maybe didn't have so much exposure to other cultures. So I can see how these pornographic images were reflecting the culture. But I wonder if it's changed now, or how is it now? Is it still like this, that it's reflecting, or not really, because we are exposed to so many different things? So, you know, my brain went like 100% of work.
Yeah, I can imagine. And it's so interesting. There's a castle here down in the south of Sweden, just 40-50 kilometers away, Gårhult, I think, where it's a castle with 500 years of like history, and through the years, a lot of the men who were the owner of this castle had to be away on, you know, wars and this, that, and the other thing. So the women, their wives, it's a castle with a strong history of wives being the ones who actually take care of it and run it. So the current Slottsfru, the wife of the castle, or the lady of the castle, Alexandra von Schwerin, she's picked up on this. So she's turned this into, you know, they do farming and this, that, and the other thing, but they also have like a museum. So they have a museum where they show the history of the castle. They show the history and the importance of women throughout these years. Because if you look at the documentation, you know, deeds passed on, etc., the women doesn't show. It's the men, it's their husbands, that's the names. But they're not the ones who made this castle be such a success. It's the women, because the men were away for 10 years on, in a war.
Yeah, you know? Precisely.
But she also had, a couple of years ago, probably 5, 10 years ago maybe, she had this really, really super interesting exhibition about sex.
Mm-hmm.
Through the ages. It was just, like you say, my brain just went, poof!
Poof,
wow! Exactly. And they have, they have a lot of university history students who come there and have their summer job to be guides and talk about the history and share stuff. So they had this 25-year-old young woman, you know, history major. And she was giving a lecture, so you could watch that they had gathered, like you say, pornographic images from like the last century, showing, you know, these really funky Parisian images of ladies where maybe there was a little bit of a of an ankle showing.
Yeah,
you know, that was the height of, ooh, that's racy, right? And then on to the 60s, where it's just, you know,
precisely
free love, you know, sex, love, and rock and roll, and all of these things. It's like, but then she was giving a lecture and she said, when it comes to sex, it is such a pendulum.
Mm-hmm.
She said, if you look at the 1700s, you could have pictures in your parlor that were explicitly pornographic, in a sense. That wasn't an issue. You could, or I'm not sure it was the 1700s, but a couple of hundred years ago, right? She said, and then in the 1800s, no, flat out, no, that wouldn't even come close to it. So the pendulum of this, what's okay, what's not okay. And we live in a really, really interesting time because we live kind of in a mishmash. We have explicit pornography, explicit ads, etc. You know, look at Instagram, look at you, you know, it's like just, it's there.
The Instagram. Like,
and it cannot be, it can be pornographic in a sense. It cannot be artistic. It cannot be beautiful because those are taken off, ashamed, you know, this, that, and the other thing. So it's like, and we shouldn't talk about it in many. So it's like, we live in this mix of both the explicitness of it and don't mention the war type thing. So she, it was interesting to hear that. And she just blew my mind with, it's like, I started to think about it going, huh. And I wonder kind of where's the pendulum going?
But, you know, like when you mentioned the, for example, the images of like seeing a little bit of legs or ankles, and, you know, that's already was super sexual and exciting. At that same time, or probably much earlier, when you go to different continent in Asia, for example, there is Kama Sutra and all the images are so sexual and show different position. Then also you have, I'm reading another book. I will tell you the title in a second because I think it's a really, really cool book. I need to Google the precise title. but in that book, the doctor who wrote it, he says that many, many years ago on the caves, like in the place where he lives in States, on the caves, there are drawings from different tribes, and those drawings are super sexual, you know? But then you also see the impact of Christianism and how they draw additional things into those drawings to make them more religious. And usually that would be a cross, let's say they would draw a cross. So, yeah, but it's so fascinating, you know, and I wonder how, like, well, I kind of know, but it still kind of occupies my brain, like, why sex became such a taboo. And, you know, like, I know that sometimes, like, sex is one thing and pornography is another thing, and what they show in pornographic films often is not done right, or it doesn't show always respectable sexual activity. And there are still a lot of things that pornography has to work on and to get better, to make it safer for everyone and respectable. But when it comes to sex, like, I don't, like, when we went to for it to be such a taboo, it's such an essential, important thing in our society. For every single human being, I would say, it's like a core thing to understanding yourself, to probably feeling better about yourself. I haven't read through that research yet, but there is research that proves that having sex, enjoyable sex, sex that allows you to explore your own and your partner's pleasures, that is consensual, it has positive impact on your health. So why? It's like, you know, during now COVID times, we don't say how important is to go and exercise. No one says about this. Eat healthy, exercise. No, we don't hear about this. At least I haven't heard about this, unless from people who are personal trainers and they like post on their Instagram account or other accounts, social media, like, go and exercise, it has these benefits, yeah? Or eat healthy, it has other benefits. But we don't talk about the benefits of pleasurable sex, about discovery of our pleasures. We started, we're doing okay, but there it needs much more conversation, it needs much more exposure to different cultures and to the light in general. I'm just going to very quickly look to the book that I wanted to not it. It's the Dr. David J. Lay, I think. Hope I pronounce it right. Books. So I started reading this. It's called, sorry for the words, but well, that's the title. So it's called Ethical Porn for Dicks, a man's Guide to Responsible, I think it's to Responsible Viewing of Pleasure. Hmm. So I'll send you the link to that book, because I think, like, it's written in very respectable way, like, it's, you know, and I think it's not only for men, but for anyone who just wants to understand pornography a little bit more, in a way, in a sense, how it impacts, or actually doesn't impact, our sexuality, because, you know, that's the question. So that's another thing that I was reading in the book that we go through for the sexology, that whatever we view in the media, we kind of learn from it. We take certain behavior out of this. We try to imitate the behaviors that we see in others or on the screen, since, you know, TV, since media and internet is a big part of our lives. So we are exposed to that. We try to imitate what we see. But the other aspect is that if when we try to replicate that behavior, imitate that behavior, if the consequences of that imitations are not positive, not reinforcing that behavior, we won't repeat that behavior. But if the consequences are positive, so let's say it's a sexual behavior, we go, we do something, and the person with whom we do it, they like it, we will adapt this as our own behavior, and we will repeat that more often. So, you know, it's super, the book is interesting. I think it's eye-opening when it comes to understanding the huge range of erotic or pornographic films that we have out there. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to understand it because it's there. And I really don't think so we will be able to swipe it under a rug. And
we never have.
No.
You know, again, no, it's like, no. It is interesting to see. It's like, you know, you see dogs going at it on anything. It can be my leg, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And you don't kind of, you know, we are ashamed of it and tried, oh, no, don't do that thingy. But it's like we're embarrassed for us.
Yeah.
Not really for the dog, because that's a dog. That's what they do.
Yeah.
Sorry, but we're kind of the same. Mm-hmm. You know, we just have this cognition on top of it where we then put all of these, the judgments, the shoulds, shouldn'ts, the expectations, the what is proper and what isn't proper, and linking it to me, what is human and what is superhuman.
Mm-hmm.
So,
like, what is ego and superego? Sorry.
Yeah, and it's like, it is a part of being human, but the norm for me is to be superhuman. Hence, I have to rise above all of the petty, base, human needs, etc., turning them into something that, oh no, that's not for me. I need to be superhuman. I need to be above it, beyond it, right? Which just totally messes with my head. I think a lot of heads.
We try to achieve all the time something. I think I don't know if it's the right way of looking to it, but I think maybe we should just look at things from a learning perspective and from gaining generally experience and pleasure in what we do. Not the, like, what we're going to achieve, what's the final goal, but actually more what's the journey there, yes? Because some things ain't happen through one day. Like, you're not going to wake up and it's done. The goals are achieved. No, you as a person, you have to work really hard to achieve certain things. The things that you may have put for yourself as your goals. And I think and that's my personal point of view. Yes, it's not like, I don't know if there is any, you know, supporting research for that, but we often don't know how to enjoy the journey. And that's perhaps a problem, because it may happen that the outcome of our decisions is not good. You know, like, we made the right decision at the specific time, but the outcome isn't good. It's not something we were expecting. But the journey what we learned during that journey, what did we experience? What do we gain from that journey? You know, what sort of human being are we becoming after that experience?
And I think that probably links also to a lot of the culture of efficiency and proficiency and effectiveness and, you know, resource management. It needs to be so precise, and the leanness of the world, right? Where it's like we measure things based on the outcome. We measure. That's where you say it's good or bad. And it needs to be streamlined and efficient and, all of that. It's like, that's one way of being in the world, but it is just one way of being in the world. Yeah. It's like, there's a lot more to life than that.
You know, because I think it's much harder to measure things based on the feeling, because, you know, that's what it comes to. It's a certain feeling that you gain. You may feel well or not well about something, or good or not good about something. And it's hard to measure this journey. It's much easier to measure the outcomes. It's much easier to measure what's the final result. But rarely anyone looks to it, what did this one person went through to actually get to this final result, how thorough they were in their journey to get to that final result. Were they just, you know, cherry picking on the things and this is their report, here you go, like we're doing great or whatever, that's the final result? Or were they really thorough? They took much more time, but the result is much more meaningful. And no one really, I think many people do not pay attention to that first phase, the longer phase.
And, you know, it's like we also kind of reverse engineer. So you see these successful people and then you reverse engineer the mm-hmm. steps and then you mm-hmm. say, here's the 10 steps to become a multi-billionaire, you know, the world's healthiest, strongest man or the most beautiful woman or whatever it is. It's like, this is how it's done. No. Because you can't do it reverse engineered. You can reverse engineer it in a way that you can see what were the pivotal moments. But that is not a recipe. If I were then to do that, it doesn't work like that. Because as you say, there's a life to be had there. There's a journey to be had. And things, there's just too many unknowns out there that you can't, like, here we have identify these 10 steps, done. Mm-hmm. No, it doesn't work like that.
Precisely. And I think every person is different and each person will approach something differently, a thing differently. And each person will bring something different to the table. It's like, you know, one thing may work for that person, but then even if you try to apply the same steps to another person, it may not work. And it's because this person is different. And, you know, like they may take, it's like script. You take it, but you make it yours. Yes. Yeah. Same. So yeah, there is this theory of sexual scripts that in this we behave when it comes to our sexual behavior. We behave in a certain way and it's kind of expectable. So, for example, before there is any explicit sexual act, there will be kissing, yes? For example, we know that not always will work like this, but there is that theory of sexual scripts. But even in that theory, they say that even if you take that script, each couple will act it out in their own way, or each person will act it out in their own way. And I think same with this reverse engineering and looking to 10 steps of being successful or whatever worked for one person, another person will take it or may take it and make it your own. Make it match to yourself. So it's unique. It's unique to you, to your journey, and it fits you better. It feels better for you.
But it's interesting to talk about these things in the way that we are doing now, you know, what with pornography and sex and sexual scripts and desires and pleasure, etc. It's like I come from a world where it isn't, period. You know, I don't have any, like, real, it's not a part of the way that me and my family and the culture around me has, you know, it's just, it is. I don't know that it's hidden away, but it's not spoken about. It's just, it just isn't. And I hope that I've at least shifted that a little bit for my kids. I've deliberately tried. You know, I've wanted to because I want to have it. And my ex-husband, he comes from a family with a slightly different culture where you could speak about your body in a different way than what I come from, right? So we like, yeah, that's good. I've been inspired by that and then added on the aspect of sensuality, the aspects of sexuality, the aspects of desire and pleasure and consent, and all of these things, trying to talk about it. And this might sound weird, but show it. And I don't mean that I've been showing, because that's not okay. That is taboo in the culture that I live in and the mm-hmm. culture that you live mm-hmm. in. I was reading Peter Mathiesen, I think his name is. There's at play with the land of the gods. I don't know what it's called. It's a weird ass book written early 90s, mm-hmm. late 80s. He's in, I don't know, anthropologies, and he's in the Amazon basin, looking at some indigenous tribes
mm.
where that, you know, where the aspect of sexuality and how you are with it is just, it's so far from
yeah.
the culture that I come from that precisely. You just go, what?
Yeah, precisely.
Right? 'Cause there it's like, mothers and fathers are showing their little, you know, you can have
yeah,
sex
yeah.
and there's not, you know, everybody can watch, and you help your kids to
yeah.
figure out what pleasure is on their body. And it's like, it's just, oh, that's so taboo. You know,
yeah.
you cannot.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that's a good way and what we do is a bad way.
No.
And I'm guessing that just as I can have a warped view of sex and sexuality because of the culture, you can do that in that culture too. And it might suit some people better and might
yep.
suit some people worse, you know? So it's like, it's not that's how to do it, but rather so interesting that there are so different
exactly.
ways of doing it. And kind of my analytical mind goes all, oh, and what does it lead to? How much of the suffering that we see in our disembodied Western culture comes from the fact that we are so not in touch with an embodied experience? And what other issues are there in a culture that is much more in touch with the embodied experience? Maybe they have a complete set
yeah.
of other problems that we don't see because, you
That's-
know.
Yes. And, you know, I think it's very important what you just said, because it's not that what it's in our culture is bad and we, you know, we should be ashamed of that because we weren't raised in a, let's say, more sexual way or something like this. And neither to say that what's in the other cultures happening because they're more open sexually is bad. It's different. And what I think it's important is to be curious and open to learn or at least experience in some way what other people do in other cultures. And I'm not, when I say experience, I don't mean jump into it and do it as they do, but just listen, learn what is this other culture, how they live. And as you say, what other problems they have because they live like this, or what other joys they have because they live like this, you know, and see if there is anything that you can learn from them, like take as your own, or maybe it's not what you need or are ready to accept. And that's fine. But let's not argue. Let's have a conversation. Let's have an open-minded conversation where we can learn new things, where we can learn about new cultures or different cultures, maybe. That's more right to say. And as I say, don't argue, just listen. Have your opinion. Of course, everyone has their opinion. You can even express your opinion, do it in a kind way, and allow further conversation. Because I think that's important. Instead of just shutting the door, saying, no, you're right, this is bad, I don't want to talk about this. And again, I guess it depends on the comfort of another person, what they feel comfortable to talk about and what they don't feel comfortable to talk about. But I often find myself that even if the topic is a little bit uncomfortable for me, if the conversation is a respectful conversation, I feel more open and okay to talk about certain topic. Sometimes I may have not enough knowledge, and then I will say, look, I don't know much about this. Tell me more. I wonder, I may not agree with everything at that point. But if I want, I will do my further research because I open myself up to this other person. I listen to them. I was like, okay, that's interesting. Let me process that in my head.
So in the sexology class that you're taking, or course that you're taking, are you in conversation with the other students? Is there like active interaction? Because I'm guessing that that's where a lot of the riches might come from.
Yes, there are two different, one is Facebook group where there are a huge amount of those students who in the past attended the course and who are attending right now. Then there is another platform that they use for discussion. The discussion can happen also during the online sessions. We can also directly email the professor or people who appear in those lectures. And what's the cool thing is from that professor that he encourages us to actually have the conversation. What he repeats often is, go ahead, have conversation. Don't like be open to talk to other people. And he says that often by what he is posting on Facebook or in this other platform is to initiate open-minded conversation on different topics, because they're like, people have different opinions and their own point of views, and that's fine, but let's learn from each other, let's talk. So that's what I really like, and I like that I'm exposed to different professionals who are interested in the topic of sexual behavior, human behavior. And yeah, there is still a lot to go through, you know, like sexual health, sexual behavior in different age, when you like, you know, child growing up, etc. Obviously, different theories, sexual theories, or, you know, the research, how the research is done, and what is a questionable research, because, you know, like often for me, that's especially important, because I often find myself to go to different research online, and I would like to know how legit is that research. I mean, you know, was it peer reviewed or wasn't? Can I support my findings with this research, or I shouldn't yet because it needs more development? So yeah, I find it super interesting, and you know, I'm super happy that I actually enrolled in it, and to see what it will bring to me, and you know, how it will help to develop for Red Chicks also, because yeah, it's connecting all together.
And it is, I don't know, for me, it's like there's a hopeful stream in this, in that, you know, it is talked about, it. As in pleasure, desire, sex, sexual drive, life force, you know, it's like, and it's talked about and it's acted upon in so many different ways, in so many different forms. There's a university course. There's a weekend course you can take in playful tantra. There's, you know, there's books yeah. to read. There's porn to watch if you yeah. want to. There's erotica or smut to read. And there's conversations to be had with your kids, with your spouse or partner, mm. with your friends, with, you know, it's like, and the I can see also how in this in one way hypersexualized world that we live in, it's like too much information can definitely be an aspect of that. It's like, don't tell me, I don't want to know what you do in the bedroom. It's like, please, hush. And at the same time, the aspect of in the hypersexualized world that I see when it comes to this, I want to see more of the aesthetic, of the sensual, of the, mm-hmm. of the, it's like in the hypersexualized, it's as if it's zoomed in, you know, close up, nitty gritty, this is it. The other side that I'm much more attracted to is this, it's slightly zoomed out. It's like, yeah. it can be even a bit hazy. It's like, you don't really, it's like, what's there? And you're, I am allowed to use my imagination much, much more. So watching porn, it doesn't really do anything for me. Yeah, sure, yeah. it can get me turned on, but I don't, not my entire being. Reading, if mm-hmm. it's well-written erotica, mm.
Like, yeah,
that can open up because all of me is somehow engaged there because it isn't the explicitness of it. So,
yeah,
and that's me.
Exactly. And look, every person is different. Some may lean toward more explicit visual material and some other will prefer something that involves their imagination more. And that's fine. We are all different. And another thing that I wanted to say, maybe just like, I guess, a little bit at the end, but I think it's so important that what you do, that you have conversations with people on the podcast and you publish it. Because like this, people can experience different people, basically, different voices, different ways of thinking. And podcasts and conversations like this, they are a great form. And that's important. As important as having more explicit or less explicit sexual things on internet or in books. And, you know, conversation is very, well, very important. I'll just mm-hmm. loop back to that same word, important. That's it.
Yeah, it carries potential. It carries, it's like, it's in a sense, it's like, here's a bag of seeds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like,
see
what you do with it, you know, and what will come out of it. Will it be flowers mm-hmm. or vegetables or weeds? You know, yeah. it's like, and what's yeah. a weed really? You know, it's like, what's there? Mm-hmm. So I agree with you. I guess that's a good place to end this. It's like, yeah, now we've given you this bag full yes. of seeds. Take a few and do something with them, you know.
Precisely.
Toss them out in the garden and see what comes
and
up.
And see what's happened. Precisely.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for today. It was actually a very good start of the day.
I'm very, very happy to hear that. Thank you. We have one more conversation to go.
Yeah.
This is our fourth.
Yeah. I think I will miss them, to be honest.
Yeah, I know. That's why I say I don't know how I will ever stop doing this podcast series. Mm-hmm. And when season one came to close, it was like, what? I won't be talking to these people. I do still talk to all of them. But like this is like, but I can't keep at it with everybody because then yeah. I won't do anything
yes,
besides
yes, you
being
need to
conversation
keep getting people yes
yeah.
yeah
but I'm already starting to think about who will be in season 3.
That's good
yeah.
yes Because the more conversation you have, the better for yourself and for others. Yeah. More seats to give away.
I learn a lot. Yeah. And it's like you say, the journey of this is really what has the impact on me. The journey of being in this type of conversation with people repeatedly or multiple times, how this ripples outside of these explicit hour, 2 hour conversation is just huge in my life. So the journey I truly cherish, and the outcomes are kind of surprising. I didn't know that. I didn't expect that. It just ripples.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.